Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're going to be studying and looking at the Meyer material today. And I want to welcome all of you to the show. Edward Albert Meyer, he's a one-armed farmer from Switzerland. He lives in a tiny mountain village called Hinterschmidruti, which is about an hour east of Zurich, Switzerland. He's had extraterrestrial contact since about the age of 5 years old. And back in 1945, he would get these telepathic messages to go out into the Horrigan Forest near his home in Niederflachs, which was in Bulach, Switzerland. And out of the sky would come a silvery pear-shaped craft, which would land in a field nearby. And out would step Svoth, an elderly man of about 1,000 years old. Svoth was from a race of extraterrestrial humans that allowed themselves to be called the Pleiadians, but they're not from our Pleiades. They're from some 80 light years beyond our Pleiades, in a different space and time configuration, in a star system they call the Pleiades star system. They live on a world called Era. And Era is a very beautiful place with a ecosphere very similar to the Earth. They have plants and animals and humans living on their world. They have a very much thicker atmosphere than we do. They haven't destroyed their ozone with atomic testing. They don't use atomic power. They don't pollute their air or their water. They don't dam up rivers and create large lakes. They don't mine their planet. They don't extract petroleum from their world. They don't do fracking. They keep their human population low, so all the other populations on the planet can stay high, like the animals. They don't destroy the habitat of the animals. They live without large cities. They don't stack people on top of each other in the large cities. They don't build roads. They don't travel on the surface of their planet. They have craft to fly from place to place. They only work about 2 hours a day. The rest of the time they spend in a kind of pursuit of knowledge as well as spiritual growth. The life expectancy on their world is very high. Humans live to be 1,000 years old, which is really about the correct amount of lifespan for a human being. Here on the Earth, our lifespans have been shortened from various reasons, one of which is the genetic manipulation that we had many, many years ago. But that's another story for another time. Maybe we can get into that a little bit this afternoon. Svoth walked over to young Billy, who was waiting in the forest there, and he led young Edward Albert Meyer into the ship. And the ship rose up some 70,000 meters above the ground, and young Billy had a global view, if you will, of the beautiful blue world, the same view many of our astronauts talk about, and they talk about how inspiring that is to see that. And you start to understand that our world is very special. And I think that's one of the reasons Svoth took him up there. Billy looked around in the ship and he could see consoles on which people were being displayed. And originally he thought they were windows or portals or something to that effect. Now, Svoth put a device on Billy's head that unlocked the wisdom of his predecessor personalities. You see, Edward Albert Meyer has been Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. So his spirit has incarnated on the earth for the past 13,000 years. And he's done missions similar to the one he's currently involved in. In other words, in this lifetime, he's teaching an ancient universal teaching called the Teaching of the Spirit, which focuses on at least five different areas: the universal consciousness, the human spirit, reincarnation, learning to control our thoughts, and taking personal responsibility. Sloth told Billy that his mission here on the earth was very important, but that it would take about 800 years for it to come to fruition. He was told that he would have a difficult lifestyle, a difficult life, that there would be many attempts on his life, that people would ridicule him, that his own wife would ridicule him and call him a hoaxer, and that a time of confusion and maliciousness was spreading over the earth. There would be a slowly coming global collapse. And Sloth identified this as the third millennium. That's the term he used to describe the age that we're heading into. And he said during the third millennium that the rulers of the earth, the leaders of the earth here, would start to take away our rights of self-determination, and that the people would become indolent and obtuse and indifferent, and also slowly become more and more angry at the circumstances around them. And this will lead to conflict and warfare, and our increasing population will lead to the destruction of the natural world and to certain diseases that will continue to occur. And there will be various outbreaks of this. And I want to play a little clip where David Suzuki talks about overpopulation.
You know, there are a lot of things that we can fix in this world. We can do something about it. We can design the cities that we live in, the kinds of houses we live in, the market, the economy, currency, how many trees we're going to cut, how many fish we're going to catch. Those things human beings can manage and control because we create them and do them. But some things are facts of life we have to live with. The speed of light, gravity, entropy, the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Those are things that we have to accept and work ourselves around. And there is another one that is absolutely crucial. It's a mathematical reality called exponential growth. If something is growing at 1% a year, it'll double in 70 years. 2% a year, it'll double in 35 years. 3% a year in 24 years. 4%, 17 and a half years. Anything growing exponentially will double in a predictable length of time. Now I'm going to show you why all of this stuff about we got to keep growing, keep the economy growing, we've got to keep everything growing, is ultimately suicidal. I'm going to give you a system analogous to the planet, and that's a test tube full of food for bacteria. So the test tube and food is the planet, and the bacteria are us. Now I'm going to introduce one bacterial cell in, and it's going to divide every minute. That's exponential growth. So at time zero, at the beginning, there's one cell. 1 minute, there are two. 2 minutes, there are four. 3 minutes, there are eight. 4 minutes, 16. That's exponential growth. And at 60 minutes, the test tube is completely packed with bacteria and there's no food left. So we have a 60-minute growth cycle. When is the test tube only half full? Well, of course, the answer is at 59 minutes. Even though it's been chugging along for 59 minutes, it's only half full, but 1 minute later, it'll be completely filled. So that means at 58 minutes, it's 25% full. 57 minutes, it's 12.5% full. At 55 minutes of a 60-minute cycle, it's 3% full. at 55 minutes, one of the bacteria says, "Hey guys, I've been thinking, we got a problem. We got a population problem." The other bacteria would say, "Jack, what the hell have you been smoking, man? 97% of the test tube's empty and we've been around for 55 minutes. And they'd be 5 minutes away from filling it. So, say bacteria are no smarter than humans. At 59 minutes, they go, "Oh my God, Jack was right. We got 1 minute left. What are we going to do?" Well, don't give any money to those economists that are saying we got to keep growing all the time. Give it to those scientists. So they massively inject money into the scientific community. And guess what? In less than a minute, those bacterial scientists invent 3 new test tubes full of food. That'd be like us finding 3 more planets that we could use. What happens? In 60 minutes, the first test tube's full. 61 minutes, the second's full. 62 minutes, all 4 are full. By quadrupling the amount of food in space, we buy 2 extra minutes. Our home is the biosphere. It's fixed and finite. It can't grow. And we've got to learn to live within that finite world. Every scientist I've talked to agrees with me. We've already passed the 59th minute.
That's why I entitled the show Respect for Nature or Global Disaster. It's really our choice. One of the things that Sfoth taught Billy was that everything in the universe is one and that we're all connected. If you go back to the archetypal Big Bang, then that you can see the indisputable logic of that. Billy's contacts with Sfoth lasted for about 11 years, and then he was told that he would get his second teacher. Now, his second teacher was a woman named Asket, who was from the Tao universe, a parallel universe to ours, that was also created 46 trillion years ago when our Big Bang occurred. Asket met with Billy from the time he was 16 years old till about 27 years of age. And one of the things Asket taught Billy about was the danger of the religions on the earth and the confusion that our religions currently have. And she talked about a group of people that lived far below the Giza Plateau in these old 72,000-year-old cubicle constructions that used a kind of telenotic impulse to manipulate the people of Earth and appeared to the people of the Earth at different times as gods and angels in order to kind of manipulate them and literally to try to create a control structure for the whole Earth so that this splinter group of the Plearn could literally control our Earth using this kind of religious mind control. So Billy had decided to study the religions of the world, and he traveled through India and studied at the Ashoka Ashram. Also in the Middle East, he lost his left arm in a bus accident. And then he also met his wife, a Greek woman named Calliope, and he moved back to Switzerland. And he had 11 years of a normal life. He had children, worked a regular job, that sort of thing, had 3 children. And then about 1975, his contacts picked up again. And he would get visits from a Plearn woman named Semyase, who was the granddaughter of Sfoth. And she would land her beam ship there in Hinterschmidruti and come over to Billy, and she would talk to him about something she called the creation. And the creation is the universal consciousness. It's the superintelligence which created our universe. It has a physical component, which is the structure of our universe. Plus, it has a spiritual component, which is actually the intelligence behind the creation of our universe. Now, the universal consciousness or the creation is not does not correspond to the religious notion of God that we have here on the earth. It's not a personality. It has no personality. In the German, it's referred to as a Wesenheiten. And a Wesenheiten is more like air, more like the water, rather than a personality that takes on anthropomorphic qualities. In other words, the universal consciousness doesn't become angry or jealous. It's not vengeful. It doesn't get involved in human wars. It's a neutral, positive entity. The universe that we live in is the material manifestation of the wisdom of the universal consciousness. And Semyase would describe the creation this way. She would say that wisdom and love go together, and that the creation and its laws are wisdom and love at the same time. Now, Billy, later in life, would also write many books, and based on the wisdom he got from his extraterrestrial contacts, also from the information that he could pull out of the storage banks of the universe. Evidently, our universe stores much of the knowledge and the wisdom. Every one of us has a human spirit, and when we die, that human spirit comes out of our body and it goes into the spiritual realm, where at the appropriate time, it's placed back into the body of a child. But while we're on the spiritual, in the spiritual realm, our previous life memories are stored in what's called the storage banks. And we there is some preparation process for the next life. And then we're placed back into the body of a child. 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg, the human spirit is placed into what's called the superior colliculus, which is an area of the midbrain. And that area of the midbrain is associated with sight and with eye movement. And there's been various studies that have been done regarding mammals and regarding the superior colliculus. There's also something called the tectum. And in the tectum is the inferior colliculus as well as the superior colliculus. And all of this is associated with the midbrain. And my understanding is the midbrain is what connects the two lobes, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And it's the midbrain where our higher perception occurs, like things like remote viewing, extrasensory perception, telepathy, telekinesis, come from the area of the midbrain. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. But one of the important concepts associated with the creation, even though it's a neutral entity, it radiates love. And it radiates love kind of like the sun radiates light. It doesn't really personally love us. Remember, it has no personality. So it doesn't personally love us, but it radiates love. And Billy has written that the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation, and that creation radiates love, so that at every point in time, at every place, we can sense the radiating love of creation. And in the German, there's a spiritual process. It's called Empfinden, which is our spiritual ability to be able to detect this radiating love. And it's tied in to being a good observer. Because if we observe creation, one of the incredible things that we can see are the repeating patterns of creation. For example, if you look at lightning, which forms during a storm, it has a branching pattern very similar to the branching structure of trees. So we see these very interesting repeating patterns. My understanding is that the angle of each one of these branching patterns is the same as what's called the golden mean that mathematicians talk about. There's also a branching structure in our circulatory system. So at the microcosm and the macrocosm, we see these same repeating patterns. And love is the highest principle in creation. And from that principle, everything else follows the logic of that principle. Now, there's a researcher named Greg Braden that's starting to do some studies on what he calls the divine matrix, or what I would call the universal consciousness. So I thought it might be interesting to listen to a little bit of this Greg Braden interview.
So people ask the question, what about their own negativity, their own negative feelings, thoughts, emotions, and beliefs, and how their inner experiences of negativity may affect what it is that they share in the divine matrix? And what the ancient traditions say about this experience is nothing new. It's the same experience in humanness now that we had 2,500 years ago. And what the ancient traditions in the text say is that our experience is only an experience, not positive, not negative, until we judge our personal experience, until we give it an importance based on our perceptions and our beliefs. And until we do that, it is simply an experience. So the question is, why are we judging ourselves, and how do we judge ourselves? And the healing comes from allowing us to feel whatever it is that the world gives to us to feel. And to acknowledge that feeling and say, yes, this is a feeling. Sometimes it's a good feeling, sometimes it's a bad feeling. But to allow the feeling to unfold without judging what the feeling means or being afraid of how it may affect something else in the world. The feelings that we call negative are simply indicators, indications that something has crossed our path that now is inviting us to examine this experience. Why do I feel this way? What is it saying to me? And they become a problem only when we ignore them, when they go unresolved, unreconciled feeling is the term that we use. When the feelings are unresolved and we bury or mask our hurt or our frustration or our anger or our jealousy or our rage, and we do that month after month, year after year, and that feeling is buried inside of us looking for an expression, that's where we begin to have the problems. But the feeling itself, when we have a feeling, I have negative feelings, and I don't judge them. I say, I'm having a feeling about this person or about this situation. And then I have to check with myself and say, why am I having this feeling? What does it mean to me? What is it telling me about my personal beliefs and my personal experience? And in that way, the negative feelings become our best friends because they actually serve us rather than hurt us. And it's all based in our beliefs and the judgment that we attach to that experience. The ancient Essenes tell us in their texts, 2,500 years ago, very precise language, that every human lives in this earth in three worlds at the same time. We live in the world of thought, the world of feeling, and the world of emotion. And their texts actually say to us, when these three become one, when the thought and the feeling and the emotion are merged, are married together into a single potent force, then when you say to the mountain, move, the mountain will move. Now, I used to believe that this was a metaphor, And now I have seen in the monasteries of Tibet, and I've seen with the holy and the sacred people in Bolivia and Peru, in the native traditions of the desert southwest, in the medicineless hospitals in Beijing, China, this is not a metaphor. It is a literal fact. When thought, feeling, and emotion become one, we literally can change the stuff our world is made of. We can rearrange the atoms of matter through the belief waves that emanate from our heart. So the question is, when we are experiencing judgment in ego, what is that saying to us really? Well, the first thing it's telling us is that we are not in our heart, because the heart has no judgment and the heart has no ego. When we are experiencing those qualities, it is coming from our mind. It's coming from our inner child. It's coming from our fear, from our families, our perceptions, our conditioning. It's not coming from our heart. And this is so interesting to me, because I'm using the English language now. And in the English language, the language is not designed for this conversation. Other languages are. Sanskrit, for example, ancient Sanskrit. In Sanskrit, there is one word that means the energy body of the human, for example. It is prana. In English, there is no single word for prana, so we have to take other words, put them together, energy body or electrical magnetic field or something like that. And the same is true when we speak about the language of the heart. There is no word in the English language that describes the language of the heart. Part of my heritage is Southeastern Cherokee, Native American Cherokee. And in that tradition, there is a word that means the single eye of the heart that doesn't see right and wrong and good and bad. It simply sees what has happened with no judgment. And that word is Shanti Ishta, the single eye of the heart. And so the goal of many ancient traditions, early Christian, early Jewish, early Buddhist, Native American, and now the scientific principles today, is to find a way to view the experiences of life, what happens in the world around us, our relationships, our finances, our health, through the single eye of the heart, the eye that says, yes, this is what has happened, without saying what has happened is good or bad or right or wrong. And when we find ourselves having those experiences, we are in our mind. And it is the marriage of the mind and the heart that give us the power to create. And the way they say to transcend, to get through the judgment that we find ourselves in, it sounds strange at first. But what they invite us to do is this. When something hurts us in life, when something crosses our path that causes us pain, our first reaction is to move away from it, to say, I don't want that. And that is when the judgment comes in. If we can embrace the experiences when someone or an experience hurts us in life, not that we like the experience or we want to have it again, but the ancients say that we should bless the experience. And this sounds very strange, to bless the things that hurt you. But here's what happens. When we begin to bless the things that cause us the pain, the blessing is simply the acknowledgement. When you say, I bless the person who has just been dishonest with me. I bless the person who has violated my trust, betrayed my confidence. And you say that again and again, and you say it out loud. What begins to happen is the verbal expression brings the physical energy up from the heart into the body. And soon your body becomes warm and you have tears in your eyes. And you say, I bless this person, I bless this person. And it is the blessing that relieves the charge of the judgment for just a moment. And that's all we need. Because for just a moment, when the charge is relieved, we can replace the hurt with something else. And the ancients say that something else is what we call beauty. Beauty is a powerful force in our world, and it already exists everywhere. The ancient Essenes and the Native Americans alike, they say that beauty is already everywhere in everything. Our job is to find that beauty, to seek it out. Now, Mother Teresa was a master at this. She would walk down the streets of Calcutta, India, and she would see dead bodies on the street and decay in the gutters. And in the dung in the gutter of the streets in Calcutta, she would find a flower growing, and in that flower she would find beauty in the streets. And that experience allowed her the strength to find even more beauty in life. So rather than judging the experiences, when they come to us, if we can look at each experience as a blessing, and when we find ourselves hurt, say, again, yes, I feel hurt. So acknowledge it first. Secondly, what is this hurt saying to me? What voice am I hearing? What does it tell me about my life? And bless the hurt now that is giving us.
I think Greg Braden, wherever he says heart, I would separate or substitute the word human spirit. I think he's on to some interesting ideas. He talks about the divine matrix, which I think is the universal consciousness. There is a physical structure to our universe, and the Meyer material talks about seven layers. If you could look at our universe, it would exist of seven layers. If you could cut it open like you'd chop down a tree, you'd see these seven concentric circles or seven layers. Our universe is kind of egg-shaped, and all of these seven layers of material, they counter-rotate against one another. According to Meyer material, 46 trillion years ago, our universe was created in an archetypal Big Bang, and a second parallel universe was also created called the Tao universe. Our universe has seven layers. The fourth layer is the material belt that contains all of the stars and the planets and the solar systems and the galaxies. You know, the planets rotate around the stars, the solar systems rotate around the galaxy rotates around black holes. We see all these repeating patterns. There are between 100 and 200 billion galaxies in our universe, some of our scientists tell us. Many of these galaxies are much larger than ours. Our Milky Way galaxy is 100,000 light years across. So if you were in a spacecraft that was flying at the speed of light, it would take 100,000 years for you to fly across our galaxy. The Meyer material says not only in our galaxy, but across the universe, there are these different time-space configurations or different time planes. Now, the Pleiaren are human beings. They exist in a different time plane than we do, a different dimension, if you will. And about 50,000 years ago or so, my understanding is they finally solved the problems of warfare and poverty and disease on their planet. And they live in the fifth stage of human evolution, which is what we would call creational wisdom. Now, we here on the Earth are still in stage two, which is rational life. We're not always rational beings, but we have the capability to act rationally. At stage three, we move into intelligence. In the fourth stage, that's what's called real life. And some of these extraterrestrial human civilizations in our Milky Way galaxy live in real life. That's a maturity stage. And they can travel from star to star with almost no time passing. They use kind of a hyperspace technology to jump from star to star system. They're also genetic engineers. And they can create organic intelligence. Right now, we create mechanical intelligence through the CPUs of our computer systems as a kind of intelligence, maybe not true intelligence. But the Pleiaren, in their beam ships, their central computer is organic. And not only that, it's sentient. So in the case of Semyase, She has telepathic communication with her ship, which essentially is a living being with a metallic hull. So there are seven stages of this evolution. The fifth stage, which is creational wisdom, some of these people living in this stage become what they call the Ishwish, or the king of wisdom. And they have their superior calliculus, and the human spirit has developed to the degree where they can do telepathy, telekinesis, levitation, and those, what we think of as are supernatural things, but I think are normal things at a certain level of evolution. Now, I talked earlier a little bit about the radiating love of creation. And one of the things that we need to learn here on the earth is true reverence for all life. And until we get to that point, we're probably going to continue to destroy our natural world at an alarming rate. Now, one of the most important areas are our forests. And the forests moderate weather. They create shade in the summer, which keeps temperatures moderate. It's the drastic change in temperatures that can cause things like tornadoes. They also absorb tremendous amounts of water, which stops the flooding and the landslides and sinkholes and things like that. They also provide shelter for animals. They stop the intense blowing of the winds. All of the aspects of nature are important for global health, global stability. And the incredible increasing human populations all over the world are destroying the natural forests. For example, in Bangladesh, a little country the size of Ohio, we have 167 million people. So one of the important things that we need to do is to start to gain a true reverence for all life, for nature, because we either have respect for nature or we're going to have a global disaster. So here, let's listen to a little bit of information about the rainforest.
The heart of the rainforest. Here we can discover the secrets of a world 100 million years old. The forest has survived from prehistoric times, outlasting the dinosaurs. Huge trees stand like monuments amidst the symphony of life. Shrouded in a translucent veil, millions of living organisms compete for light beneath the canopy. Layer upon layer, life here exists. Harmony. Trees in the rainforest have been known to live as long as 350 years and grow to nearly 200 feet tall. Throughout the forest, trees seek sunlight. Its energy allows them to process the nutrients they need to survive. A soft carpet of moss covers these ancient Arctic beech trees as they reach ever skyward in search of the light. Water, the great sustainer of life in the rainforest. These rivers and streams are the veins and arteries of the rainforest ecosystem. The rainforest canopy shields its vulnerable inhabitants from the harsh surrounding elements. It also serves as a home. High up in the trees, we can find birds living among the branches of the canopy. In some areas of the rainforest, the moisture in the air forms a fine blanket of mist. The mist filters the sunlight into a soft haze. Elsewhere, beams of sunlight cut through the forest, creating dramatic glowing rays. Looking high into the canopy, countless trees can be seen competing for their place in the forest. Further below, however, other forms of life are involved in their own struggles. The forest teems with insect life. Nature's tiny soldiers. They are inhabitants of almost any location on Earth and flourish in the lush and fertile world of the forest floor. Imagine for a moment the enormity of the world as these creatures see it. Every stick and leaf would compare to the size of a building or a freeway. Their day is busy with exploration and foraging for food. Ants follow the trails of other ants. With complex and subtle chemical communication, ants can talk perfectly to one another. Many creatures travel the same pathways. For this caterpillar, it's a lonely, solo journey. Different insects have their own ways of getting from place to place.
Every tiny plant, every tiny animal in creation fulfills its purpose in creation. And we should be able to look at a tree and recognize the principle of love, because love is the highest principle in creation. And everything follows that principle in absolute logic. See, this universal consciousness radiates love, and the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of that love. Billy has a writing. It's called The Goblet of Truth, and it has a paragraph in it entitled, What the Truth Knows to Say. And it goes on to explain that rivers, lakes, trees, stones, the air, the water, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time, which involve many, many lifetimes. And that death is just the passage to rebirth. Rebirth into the world of pure spirit. And many of these creatures are connected by psychic vibrations, so they communicate with one another. And you can see that if you go into the forest, you can listen for the communication of nature. Listen for the cicadas, for the birds, for the peepers, for the frogs. There's all these aspects of creation, they communicate with one another. You can watch the birds as they move from tree to tree, especially this time of the year, as a unit, as if there is an invisible connection. There is an invisible connection between all of nature. Only man, with his consciousness, can close himself off from the radiating love of creation. And if you close yourself off from the radiating love of creation, the world will appear like a place without love, even though love is the highest principle in creation. And because we've closed ourselves off to creation here on the earth, we've just about created a global disaster with the destruction of our forests, the pollution of our water, the pollution of our air. We've destroyed nature, and nature is what sustains our world, sustains our planet. And when Billy was a very young boy, growing up in Niter Flocks, one May evening, about 3 a.m., he woke up, climbed out a lower window in his bedroom, and he looked up at a beautiful starry night, and he saw the beautiful light that radiated from the stars. And he recognized that there was another light, an invisible light, which he called the radiating love of creation. And he said that my life exists because of the radiating love of creation. And without the radiating love of creation, nothing would exist that does exist. So let's listen to another clip here on our rainforest.
As the cool air blows in off the ocean, humidity builds over the forest. The air is heavy with condensation, culminating in the spectacular and frequent downpours that give these magnificent regions their name, rainforest. Droplets of rain fall, a teasing prelude to the approaching downpour. Rain falls in vast quantities in the forest, with millions of liters pouring down each day. It falls in greater quantities than in any other environment on Earth. The plants will only absorb about one quarter of the rainfall. The rest will soak into the soil, flow into the streams, or simply evaporate into the air, creating a humid rainforest environment. Long after the rain has stopped, drops of water continue to fall from the leaves and branches of the canopy, eventually trickling to the forest floor. Groundwater continues to flow, freshly joining myriad streams that weave through the forest. For some trees, this can prove disastrous. Having grown so tall in the desperate quest for sunlight, many trees lack the root structure to stay upright in the softened ground. It can be a dangerous world, where each day is a battle for survival. But with each drop of rain, the canopy is open to new light. New plant life is given its chance to strive for the top. Early in the new day, we find the rufous fantail. This mystical and rarely seen bird uses a spider's cobweb to stitch her nest together. She has scouted the forest for small twigs and fine grasses that will enable her nest to withstand the harshest of weather conditions. The multicolored king parrot. This magnificent bird eagerly feasts on sweet berries, taking advantage of the morning light. The rainforest is home to many amazing wonders, like this giant fungus. It spreads its spores by releasing them as a fine powder into the morning air. This beautiful landscape provides all the essentials for raising a family. The rufous fantail takes every precaution to keep her eggs from harm. She is an alert mother and guards her eggs jealously through the long incubation. Lush moss.
Semyase, when she met with Billy back in 1975, she talked about the human spirit. She said, the human bears a spirit that does not sleep nor die. It records all thoughts and motions. It is human, whether his correct. He has paid it. It is creation of wonderful consciousness itself, or to help it to evolve to a higher level. It is called the form. The superior colliculus refers to this bump on the lateral part of the midbrain. The midbrain, or mesencephalon, as it's called, is a portion of the central nervous system that's associated with vision, hearing, motor control, sleep/waking, arousal, meaning alertness, and also your temperature regulation. And the technical term for the midbrain is called the tectum, and it consists of the inferior colliculi as well as the superior colliculus. Now, in some non-mammal species, including fish and birds, the tectum is one of the largest components of the brain. In mammals, especially primates, the massive cerebral cortex reduces the tectum in the superior colliculus, which is a much smaller fraction of the brain. Now, this is interesting. The superior colliculus is also beside the pineal gland. Even there, it remains very important in terms of function. Its function of the superior colliculus is integrating. It's the integrating center for eye movements. Now, from the 70s to the 90s, we did neural recordings from animals, mostly monkeys, focused primarily on the role of the superior colliculus in controlling eye movements. And in the late 1990s, experiments using animals with their head free were free to move showed clearly that the superior colliculus actually produces gaze shifts, usually combined of head and eye movements rather than eye movements alone. This discovery reawakened interest in the breadth of functions of the superior colliculus and led to studies of multisensory integration in a variety of species and situations. Nevertheless, the role of the superior colliculus in controlling eye movements is understood. So we understand that the superior colliculus is about eye movements, and it's the place where our human spirit resides. Remember, your human spirit has reincarnated many, many times and in many, many lifetimes. And when your human spirit is placed into the body of a child, 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg, you'll get a new material consciousness, and the wisdom of your predecessor personalities is placed in your subconscious. And as that child grows up again, it will receive inspiration from its predecessor personalities, which are located in the subconscious, and it will have impulses that come down from the storage banks. Remember, a human being is a wizen. Your dogs, your cats, all higher animals are wizen. We have personalities. And the human has a kind of evolution based on consciousness. So our consciousness is evolving from lifetime to lifetime. And that human spirit, which is located in your superior colliculus, is no larger than a needle point, but its enormous energy spreads out evenly, like a filigree web, over all parts of the human body, inside and out. And it doesn't lose a single iota of its power. Now, spiritual reincarnation, my understanding, lasts something like 420 billion years. But in the fifth stage, or the fifth stage of evolution, creational wisdom is when we start to lose the need for a physical body. And literally, at that stage, which I think occurs about 60 million years from our first incarnation, the physical body will slowly start to dematerialize or fade. And in the sixth stage, we'll be half physical and half spiritual. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about the incredible might of our thoughts. Billy's book, The Might of Thoughts, is dedicated to a humankind that is ill in its consciousness. Now, what happens here on the earth is what's called asartang, which means to get very bad, out of control of the human nature, the good nature. Negative thinking leads to asartang just as much as positive thinking does. So we need to have a neutral, positive thinking in our thought. Remember Greg Baden, when he was talking about placing judgment on your thoughts? And then that's when they become either positive or negative. Rather, we should remain in completely neutral status about things that happen in our life. Don't judge them as good or bad, just observe them. The might of the thinking in every human being is very important. And we have to learn to stop doing things that we do not want to do. We do things without even knowing why. Now, you have to look at our thoughts much like we would look at a garden. And we need to focus on the neutral, positive, important thoughts. These thoughts are like good plants in a garden, and we need to make those thoughts grow. That's why Billy states that the human being must make an effort to clarify his or her thoughts so that they become more valuable, more purposive, more productive. And for me, clarifying the thoughts is when I go over and over again over something. And it makes things less confused and more comprehensible. And we should practice clarifying our thoughts, because our consciousness is much like a garden. And if we don't correctly maintain it, there will be wildly growing negative thoughts which can have a confusing and destructive effect. These wildly growing thoughts are much like the weeds that appear in our garden. So we need to reach in, grab those weeds by the roots, and pull them out. These weeds, these wildly growing, uncontrolled thoughts, they can develop a life of their own. And they can choke out all the good thoughts. And we have to watch for negative repeating thoughts. And I want to read this little section from the Might of Thoughts book. But the reason that physically disturbed human beings of all kinds only see black in black, and therefore negatively, is that their personal ability is very limited, whereby the world of thoughts also inevitably falls prey to limitation and is only able to move in a narrow framework which only allows limited and negative perceptions. The thoughts are thereby forced into a cycle in which the same thoughts and themes appear over and over again. Have you ever had a thought that repeated over and over again? A wildly growing thought like a weed in the garden of your consciousness, which was choking out all the other good thoughts? Once such a rotation of the thoughts begins to operate, the human being who is controlled by it is barely able to free him or self. So these thoughts can be so negative and so powerful that we can't free ourselves. Have to broaden your perception in order to free yourself from these thoughts. Let me read again here. Only too quickly can happen that the capacity for perception is impaired through negative and wrong certain effects a delusional state is called forth. I think in many people in our world today, there is a state that has kicked in. UFO community, I see it in the religious community. As a matter of fact, there is a fine line between insanity and genius. And the human being can fall prey to any time, into delusion, into insanity, into a psychological illness. So being responsible for our thoughts and our actions not only helps us to learn towards the better and the good for this lifetime, but it also helps us in future lifetimes. Because remember, death is a temporary escape from the material world. We have to come back, and that's a thing that we've studied again and again here on Ohio Exopolitics. Here's Ian Stevenson, the work of Ian Stevenson, talking about children's past life memories.
This little boy is referred to as Sam in case studies. A year and a half before he was born, his grandfather died.
When he was about 18 months old, his dad was changing his diaper one day, and Sam looked up at him and said, "When I was your age, I used to change your diaper."
Since 1996, Dr. Jim Tucker, a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia, has been gathering case studies of past life recognition in children that could prove that a soul returns to Earth in another body.
We've now got 2,500 cases in our files from all over the world.
Many people believe in some form of reincarnation. The concept dates back to 800 BC and the Hindu Upanishads. Beginning in India, the belief that some essential part of ourselves may return after death to a new body is now being examined by some scientists as another way to prove the survival of consciousness. Can the study of past life recollections support this theory? The answer may lie within young children's memories.
Very young children, usually between the age of 2 or 3, who start reporting that they have memories from having had a past life. Some of them talk about being deceased relatives, but others will talk about being strangers in other locations. And if they give enough details, like the name of the other location, people have often gone there and found that, in fact, someone had died in the recent past whose life matches the details that the children gave.
The late psychiatrist Dr. Ian Stevenson advanced the field of reincarnation research in the 1960s, interviewing over 3,000 people who claimed to have past life memories. Two-thirds of them said that in a previous life, they died from unusual causes. He focused on 25 cases in India and realized that young children talking about past lives was much more common than anyone had known. Dr. Stevenson created categories to screen for cases worthy of further study. His colleague, Jim Tucker, still uses this method.
The criteria we use to decide whether to register a case would include two of the following characteristics: a prediction of rebirth, an announcing dream, a birthmark or birth defect that seems related to the previous life, statements of memories about the previous life, behaviors that seem related, and then also recognitions of people or places from that life.
Sam's story is an example of how a small child may express what some believe are memories of a previous life.
When Sam was 4, 4 and a half, his grandmother died, and his father went out to take care of her belongings. When he came back, he brought a group of family photos, which before that, Sam's family had not had any of his father's family photos in the house. One night, Sam's mom had them spread out on the coffee table looking at them. When Sam came over and started pointing to pictures of his grandfather.
Mommy, where did these come from?
Those are pictures Daddy brought back from Grandma's funeral.
That's my car.
You see that picture?
Turned out that that was the grandfather's first new car and one that he was very attached to. His parents had no belief in reincarnation. In fact, his mother was the daughter of a Southern Baptist minister.
Sammy, come talk to Mommy for a minute.
It's just a coincidence.
Sam's mother became intrigued by her son's statements. She started testing him with questions about his grandfather. She showed him a class photo of when his grandfather was in grammar school.
Sammy, do you recognize anyone in this photo?
There I am.
No, Sammy, that's your grandpa when he was a boy.
No, that's me.
When I looked at the picture, even after having looked at the other pictures of his grandfather, I really would not have been able to say with any certainty which boy I thought was the grandfather. And of course, Sam was 4 at the time that he did this.
Some children not only remember their past life, but the afterlife as well.
About 20% of the children will describe events between the time when the previous person died and when the child was born. Some of them describe basically sort of hanging out either where the previous person lived or where the previous person died. So they may describe their funeral. Then there are other children who talk about going to other realms like heaven, things like that. Some of them will talk about seeing other beings there or talking with God.
I died and shot up to heaven. God gave me a ticket that let me come back down to earth.
this is not part of our everyday experience to have people talking about past lives. If the children are able to describe memories that then turn out to be accurate for somebody who lived and died in the past, then this suggests that memories or something connected with memories can carry over possibly after the death of the body. I've had a number of friends and acquaintances who have said that their children, when they were two or three, would make one sort of unusual statement. Like there's one woman who said her child said, "In my last life, I drove a big truck." This is as they're riding down the road one day. Never said anything else. And, you know, you don't make too much of that. But in these cases, the children don't stop after one or two statements.
When children continue to talk about having had a past life, they may offer more specific details.
Do you remember your family?
Some people turned my sister into a fish.
Who turned her into a fish?
Some bad guys. She died.
The father had only recently heard about the sister being murdered 60 years before, and then her body had been dumped in the bay. And he felt absolutely certain that the boy had never heard about it.
Some people point out what they believe to be flaws in Tucker's studies.
How do we know all these things actually happened? That is, the boy said this, he pointed there. I presume these are anecdotes and stories told by the parents, recounted to the author, who then writes them down. We know from research on memory, from research on how much parents influence their children, and the reconstruction of events and how unreliable that is, exactly how that can be distorted.
Some people have argued that it's the parents' enthusiasm for a case that makes it stronger than it really is. So one of the things we code for is the parents' initial attitude about a case. And when I looked, I found that, in fact, the initial attitude has no correlation whatsoever with how strong the case ultimately appears to be.
Memories aren't the only signs of a former life. In Dr. Tucker's cases, a more rare occurrence is when physical characteristics carry over from one body to another, from one life to the next.
In a number of our cases, the child is born with a birthmark or a birth defect that matches a wound, usually a fatal wound, on the body of the previous person. This is something that's fairly common. Most of these are not the usual blemishes that a lot of people have, but they can be quite specific or unusual markings. There's a little boy in Thailand named Chloe. When his grandmother was dying, she expressed a wish to come back as a man. And then when she died, her daughter-in-law took some white paste and ran her finger down the back of the neck of the body. Then Chloe was born a few years later and had this white mark on the back of his neck that looked just like someone running a finger down the back of his neck. Then when he got old enough to talk, he talked about having been his grandmother, said how her rice field belonged to him, and made statements like that.
A common practice in several Asian countries involves marking the dying relative with soot or paste. When the soul is reincarnated, the family can recognize its rebirth by this mark.
Certainly, I think the birthmarks and birth defects argue that there is something that has carried that trauma with it to another life and then affected the fetus.
Of Tucker's 2,500 cases, more than 2,000 of them involved violent or unusual deaths.
Anyway, that clip is a very, very good clip, very important clip. It talks about the work of Dr. Ian Stevenson and Dr. Jim Tucker in their work in reincarnation. I suggest all of you Google Ohio Exopolitics. You'll find exopoliticsohio.us and updated website there. You can go and you can get archives from the Revolution Radio Show as well as this show. I post the blog talk shows that are about the Meyer material. I'm posting them up on the archives pages there. So Google Ohio Exopolitics, and the website is exopoliticsohio.us. Be back at 8 p.m. Eastern on Revolution Radio in Studio B. That's freedomslips.com. The first hour I will discuss the Meyer material, probably pick back up in this information to a certain degree, and then we'll be talking to Sophia Smallstorm in hour two about how the global elite use television to control our thoughts and mold them into the way to. Talk to you later. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Have a good afternoon.